I was tucked into a bed in a small room. Weak light spilled from behind a drawn window shade. So, daytime. But what day? I was in a nightgown, not my old blood-stained clothes, and my eyes were clear of grit. Someone had been taking care of me. Also, though I was bone-tired, I felt little pain. My shoulder had stopped aching, and so had my head. I wasn't sure what that meant. I tried sitting up. I had to stop halfway and rest on my elbows. A glass pitcher of water stood on a night table by the bedside. In one corner of the room was a hulking wooden wardrobe. In the other, I blinked and rubbed my eyes, making sure. Yes, there was a man sleeping in a chair. My mind was moving so sluggishly that I wasn't even startled. I merely thought, that's odd. And he was, so odd-looking, in fact, that I struggled briefly to understand what I was seeing. He seemed a man composed of halves. Half his hair was slicked down, while the other half was cow-licked all over the place. Half his face was scraggly beard, and the other half clean-shaven. Even his clothes, pants, rumpled sweater, ruffled Elizabethan collar, were half modern, half archaic. "Hello?" I said uncertainly. The man shouted, startling so badly that he fell out of his chair and landed on the floor in a clatter.
"Oh my! Oh goodness!"
He climbed back into the chair, eyes wide and hands aflutter.
"You're awake!"
"Sorry, I didn't mean to scare you."
"Ah, no, it was my fault entirely," he said,
smoothing his clothes and straightening his ruffled collar.
"Please don't tell anyone I fell asleep watching you."
"Who are you?" I asked. "Where am I?" My mind was clearing fast, and as it did, it filled with questions. "And where's Emma?"
"Right, yes," the man said, looking flustered. "I might not be the best-equipped member of the household to answer questions."
He whispered the word, eyebrows raised, as if questions were forbidden.
"But,"
he pointed at me,
"you're Jacob."
He pointed at himself.
"I'm Nim."
He made a whirling motion with his hand.
"And this is Mr. Bentham's house. He's very eager to meet you. In fact, I'm to notify him as soon as you're awake."
I squirmed up from my elbows to sit fully upright, the effort of which nearly exhausted me.
"I don't care about any of that. I want to see Emma."
"Of course, your friend."
He flapped his hands like little wings while his eyes darted from side to side, as if he might find Emma in a corner of the room.
"I want to see her. Now!"
"My name's Nim," he squeaked. "And I'm to notify, yes, under strict instructions."
A panicky thought flew into my head, that Sharon, mercenary that he was, had rescued us from the mob, only to sell us for spare parts.
"Emma!"
I managed to shout.
"Where are you?"
Nim went blank and plopped into the chair. I'd scared him silly, I think. A moment later, feet came pounding down the hall. A man in a white coat burst into the room.
"You're awake!"
he exclaimed. I could only assume he was a doctor.
"I want to see Emma,"
I said. I tried to swing my legs out of the bed, but they felt heavy as logs. The doctor rushed to my side and pushed me back toward the sheets.
"Don't exert yourself. You're still recovering."
The doctor ordered Nim to go find Mr. Bentham. Nim ran out, bouncing off the door jamb and flopping into the hall. And then Emma was at the door, out of breath and beaming, her hair spilling down a clean white dress.
"Jacob?"
At the sight of her, a burst of strength coursed through me, and I sat up, pushing the doctor aside.
"Emma!"
"You're awake,"
she said, running to me.
"Careful with him, he's delicate,"
the doctor warned. Checking herself, Emma gave me the gentlest of hugs, then sat on the edge of the bed next to me.
"I'm sorry I wasn't here when you woke up. They said you'd be out for hours more."
"It's okay," I said. "But where are we? How long have we been here?" Emma glanced at the doctor. He was writing in a small notebook, but obviously listening. Emma turned her back to him and lowered her voice.
"We're at a rich man's house in Devil's Acre. Some place hidden. Sharon brought us here a day and a half ago."
"Is that all?" I said, studying Emma's face. Her skin was perfectly smooth, her cuts faded to thin white lines.
"You look almost healed." "I only had a few nicks and bumps." "No way," I said. "I remember what happened out there."
"You had a broken rib and a torn shoulder," the doctor interjected.
"They have a woman here," Emma said. "A healer. Her body produces a powerful dust."
"And a double concussion," said the doctor. "Nothing we couldn't handle in the end. But you, boy, you were nearly dead when you arrived."
I patted my chest, my stomach, all the places I'd been pummeled. No pain. I lifted my right arm and rotated the shoulder. No problem.
"It feels like I've got a new arm," I said, marveling.
"You're lucky you didn't need a new head,"
came another voice. Sharon, ducking to fit his full height through the doorway.
"In fact, it's a shame they didn't give you one, because apparently the one you've got now is full of sawdust. Disappearing like that, running off without a clue where you were going, and after all my warnings about the Acre. What were you thinking?"
He towered over Emma and me, wagging his long white finger. I grinned at him. "Hello, Sharon. Nice to see you again."
"Yes, ha-ha, it's all smiles now that everything's rosy. But you nearly got yourselves killed out there."
"We were lucky," Emma said.
"Yes, lucky I was there. Lucky my gallows rigging cousins were available that evening, and I was able to catch them before they'd had too much ditch lager at the Cradle and Coffin. They don't work for free, by the way. I'm adding their services to your tab, along with my damaged boat."
"Fine, fine," I said. "Settle down, okay?"
"What were you thinking?"
he said again, his awful breath settling over us like a cloud. And then it came back to me, what I'd been thinking, and I kind of lost it.
"That you were an untrustworthy lout,"
I fired back.
"That it's only about money with you, and you probably would have sold us into slavery the first chance you got."
"Yeah,"
I said,
"we looked into it. We know all about the shady things you peculiars get up to around here, and if you think for a minute we believe that you," I pointed at Sharon, "or any of you," I pointed at the doctor, "are helping us purely out of kindness, you're nuts! So either tell us what you want with us or let us go, because we've got..."
A sudden, crashing wave of exhaustion, my vision unfocused.
"Got better things to..."
I shook my head, tried standing up, but the room had begun to spin. Emma held my arms and the doctor pushed me back gently onto my pillow.
"We're helping you because Mr. Bentham asked us to," he said tersely. "What he wants with you, well, you'll have to ask him yourself. Like I keep saying, Mr. Whoever can kiss my..."
Emma clapped a hand over my mouth. "Jacob's not feeling himself at the moment," she said. "I'm sure what he meant to say was, thanks for saving us. We're in your debt."
"That too," I mumbled through her fingers.
I was angry and scared, but also genuinely happy to be alive and to see Emma whole and healed. When I thought about that, all the fight leaked out of me, and I was filled with simple gratitude. I closed my eyes to stop the room from spinning and listened to them whisper about me.
"He's a problem," said the doctor. "He can't be allowed to meet Mr. Bentham like this." "His brain is addled," Sharon said. "If the girl and I could just talk with him in private, I'm sure he could be brought around. Might we have the room to ourselves?"
Reluctantly, the doctor left. When he was gone, I opened my eyes again and focused on Emma, looking down at me. "Where's Addison?" I asked.
"He got across," she said.
"Right," I said, remembering. "Have you heard from him? Has he come back yet?"
"No,"
she said quietly.
"Not yet."
I considered what that might mean, what might have happened to him, but I couldn't bear the thought. "We promise to go after him," I said. "If he can get across, so can we."
"That bridge hollow might not have cared about a dog getting across," Sharon butted in. "But you, he'd peel off and toss right into the boil."
"Go away," I said to him. "I want to talk to Emma in private."
"Why? So he can climb out the window and run away again?"
"We're not going anywhere," Emma said. "Jacob can't even get out of bed."
Sharon wasn't swayed.
"I'll go to the corner and mind my own business," he said. "That's my best offer."
He went and perched himself on Nim's one-armed chair and began to whistle and clean his fingernails. Emma helped me sit up, and we pressed our foreheads together in spoken whispers. For a moment, I was so overwhelmed by her closeness that all the questions flooding my brain vanished, and there was only her hand touching my face, brushing my cheek, my jaw.
"You had me so frightened," Emma said. "I really thought I'd lost you."
"I'm fine," I said. I knew I hadn't been, but it embarrassed me to be worried over.
"You weren't, not at all. You should apologize to the doctor."
"I know. I was just freaked out. And I'm sorry if I scared you." She nodded and then looked away. Her eyes drifted briefly to the wall, and when they returned, a new hardness glittered in them.
"I like to think I'm strong," she said. "That the reason I'm free right now instead of Bronwyn or Millard or Enoch is that I'm strong enough to be depended upon. That's always been me, the one who could take anything. Like there's a pain sensor inside me that's not switched on. I can block out awful things and get on with it, do what needs doing."
Her hand found mine atop the sheets. Our fingers knotted together, automatic.
"But when I think about you, how you looked when they pulled you off the ground, after those people..."
She let out a shaky breath and shook her head as if chasing away the memory.
"I just break."
"Me too," I said, remembering the pain I felt whenever I saw Emma hurt, the terror that gripped me every time she was in danger.
Me too.
I squeezed her hand and searched for something more to say, but she spoke first.
I need you to promise me something.
Anything, I said.
I need you not to die.
I cracked a smile. Emma didn't.
You can't, she said. If I lose you, the rest isn't worth a damn.
I slid my arms around her, pulled her tight against me. I'll do my best.
That's not good enough, she whispered. Promise me.
Okay. I won't die.
Say I promise.
I promise. You say it too.
I promise, she said.
Ah, Sharon said airily from the corner. The sweet lies lovers tell.
We broke apart.
You're not supposed to be listening, I said.
That was long enough, he said, dragging his chair loudly across the floor and planting it next to the bed. We have important things to discuss, namely the apology you owe me.
For what?
I said, irritated.
Impugning my character and reputation.
Every word was true, I said. This loop is full of scumbags and creeps, and you are a money-driven lout.
With not an ounce of sympathy for the plight of his own people, Emma added. Though, again, thank you for saving us.
Around here you learn to look out for number one, Sharon said. Everyone's got a story, a plight. Everyone wants something from you, and they're almost always lying. So, yes, I remain unapologetically self-directed and profit-motivated. But I deeply resent your suggestion that I would have dealings of any kind with someone who trades in peculiar flesh. Just because I'm a capitalist doesn't mean I'm a black-hearted bastard.
And how could we have known that? I said. We had to beg and bribe you not to abandon us at the dock, remember?
He shrugged.
That was before I realized who you are.
I glanced at Emma, then pointed to my chest.
Who I am?
You, my boy. Mr. Bentham's been waiting a long time to speak to you. Since the day I first hung my shingle as a boatman, 40-odd years ago. Bentham ensured me safe passage in and out of the acre if I promised to keep an eye out for you while I did it. I was to bring you to see him. And now, finally, I've kept my end of the bargain.
You must have me confused with someone else, I said. I'm nobody.
He said you'd be able to speak to Hologast. How many peculiars do you know who can do that?
But he's only 16, Emma said. Really 16. So how can...
That's why it took me a while to put it all together, said Sharon. I had to go see Mr. Bentham about it personally, which is where I was when you two ran away. You don't fit the description, see? All these years I've been keeping watch for an old man.
An old man, I said.
Right.
Who can talk to hollows.
As I said.
Emma tightened her grip on my hand, and we exchanged a look.
No, it couldn't be.
And then I swung my legs out of bed, charged with new energy. I want to talk to this Bentham guy. Right now.
He'll see you when he's ready, Sharon said.
No, I said. Now.
As it happened, At that very moment, there was a knock at the door. Sharon opened it to find Nim.
"Mr. Bentham will meet our guests for tea in 1 hour," he said. "In the library."
"We can't wait an hour," I said. "We've wasted too much time here already." At this, Nim went a bit red and puffed out his cheeks.
"Wasted?"
"What Jacob meant," Emma said, "is that we have another pressing engagement elsewhere in the acre that we're already late for."
"Mr. Bentham insists upon meeting you properly," Nim said. "As he always says, the day there's no time for manners, the world's lost to us anyway. Speaking of which, I'm to make sure you're dressed appropriately."
He went to the wardrobe and swung open its heavy doors. Inside were several racks of clothes.
"You may choose what you like."
Emma pulled out a frilly dress and curled her lip.
"This feels so wrong, playing dress-up and having tea while our friends and Imbrins are forced to endure bird knows what."
"We're doing it for them," I said. "We only have to play along till Bentham tells us what he knows. It could be important."
"Or he could just be a lonely old man."
"Don't talk about Mr. Bentham that way,"
Nim said, his face puckering.
"Mr. Bentham is a saint, a giant among men."
"Oh, calm down," Sharon said.
He went to the window and pulled open the blinds, allowing a weak pea-soup daylight to dribble into the room.
"Up and at 'em," he said to us. "You two have a date."
I threw back my covers, and Emma helped me out of bed. To my surprise, my legs took my weight. I glanced out the window at an empty street enveloped in yellow murk, and then, with Emma holding my arm, went to the wardrobe to pick out a change of clothes. I found an outfit on a hanger tagged with my name.
"Can we have some privacy to change, please?" I said.
Sharon looked at Nim and shrugged. Nim's hands flapped.
"It wouldn't be proper!"
"Ah, they're fine,"
Sharon said, waving his hand.
"No monkey business, all right?"
Emma turned beet red.
"I wouldn't have any idea what you mean."
"Sure you wouldn't."
He shooed Nim out of the room, then paused at the doorway.
"I can trust you not to run away again."
"Why would we?" I said. "We want to meet Mr. Bentham."
"We're not going anywhere," Emma said. "But why are you still here?"
"Mr. Bentham asked me to keep an eye on you."
I wondered if that meant Sharon would stop us if we tried to leave.
"Must be a pretty big favor you owed him," I said.
"Massive," he replied. "I owe the man my life."
And bending himself nearly in half, he squeezed out into the hallway.
"You change clothes in there,"
Emma said, nodding toward a small connecting bathroom.
"I'll change in here. And no peeking until I knock."
"Okay,"
I said, exaggerating my disappointment in order to hide it. While seeing Emma in her underwear was an undeniably appealing prospect, all the life-threatening peril we'd endured lately had put that part of my teenage brain into a kind of deep freeze. A few more serious kisses, though, and my baser instincts might start to reassert themselves. But anyway, I shut myself in the bathroom, all gleaming white tile and heavy iron fixtures, and leaned over the sink to examine myself in a silvered mirror. I was a mess. My face was puffy and cross-hatched with angry pink lines, which were healing quickly but still there, reminders of every blow I'd suffered. My torso was a geography of bruises, painless but ugly. Blood was caked into the hard-to-clean folds of my ears.
The sight of it made me dizzy, and I had to grip the sink to stay upright. I had a sudden nasty flashback, fists and feet thrashing at me, the ground rushing up. No one had ever tried to kill me with bare hands before. That was something new, much different than being hunted by hollows, which ran on instinct. Different, too, than being shot at. Bullets were a quick, impersonal way to kill. Using your hands, though, that took work. It required hate. It was a strange and sour thing to know that such hatred had been directed at me. That peculiars who didn't even know my name had, in a moment of collective madness, hated me enough to try to beat out my life with their fists. I felt shamed by it, dehumanized somehow, though I couldn't exactly understand why. It was something I'd have to reckon with, if one day I ever had the luxury of time to reckon with such things. I turned on the tap to wash my face. The pipes shuddered and groaned, but after a big orchestral flourish, they produced only a hiccup of brown water. This Bentham fellow might have been rich, but no amount of luxury could cocoon him from the reality of the hellish place where he lived. How had he ended up here? More intriguing still, how did the man know, or know about, my grandfather? Surely that's who Sharon had been referring to when he said Bentham was looking for an old man who could speak to hollows. Perhaps my grandfather had met Bentham during his war years, after he'd left Miss Peregrine's house, but before he'd come to America. It was a defining period of his life which he'd spoken about only rarely and never in detail. Despite all I'd learned about my grandfather in the past few months, in many respects, he remained a mystery to me. Now that he was gone, I thought sadly, perhaps it would always be so. I put on the clothes Bentham had given me, a preppy-looking blue shirt and gray wool sweater combo with simple black pants. It all fit perfectly, as if they'd known I was coming. As I was slipping into a pair of brown leather Oxford shoes, Emma knocked on the door.
"How are you faring in there?"
I opened the door to a blast of yellow. Emma looked miserable in an enormous canary-colored dress with poofy sleeves and a hem that swam around her feet. She sighed.
"It was the lesser of many sartorial evils, I assure you."
"You look like Big Bird," I said, following her out of the bathroom, "and I look like Mr. Rogers. This Bentham is a cruel man." Both references were lost on her. Ignoring me, she crossed to the window and looked out.
"Yes, good."
"What's good?" I said.
"This ledge. It's the size of Cornwall, and there are handholds everywhere. Safer than a jungle gym."
"And why would we care about the safety of the ledge?" I asked, joining her at the window.
"Because Sharon's watching the hole, so obviously we can't go out that way."
Sometimes it seemed like Emma had whole conversations with me inside her head, ones I wasn't privy to, and then she'd get frustrated that I was confused when she finally let me in on them. Her brain worked so quickly that once in a while it got ahead of itself.
"We can't go anywhere," I said. "We've got to meet Bentham." "And we will, but I'll be hanged if I'm spending the next hour twiddling my thumbs in this room. Saintly Mr. Bentham is an exile living in Devil's Acre, which means he's likely a dangerous lowlife with a sordid past. I want to have a look round his house and see what we can find out. We'll be back before anyone notices we're gone. Word of honor."
"Ah, good. A stealth operation. We're dressed perfectly, then."
"Very funny."
I was in hard-soled shoes that made every footstep sound like a hammer blow. She was in a dress yellower than a hazard sign, and I'd only recently found the energy to stand on my own 2 feet. And yet I agreed. She was often right about these things, and I had come to depend on her instincts.
"If someone spots us, so be it," she said. "The man's waited eons to meet you, apparently. He's not going to kick us out now for giving ourselves a little tour."
She opened the window and climbed onto the ledge. I stuck my head out cautiously. We were 2 stories above an empty street in the good section of Devil's Acre. I recognized the stack of firewood. It was where we'd been hiding when Sharon exited the abandoned-looking storefront. Directly below us was the law office of Munday, Dyson, and Stripe. There was no such firm, of course. It was a front, a secret entrance to Bentham's house. Emma offered her hand to me.
"I know you're not a great fan of heights, but I won't let you fall."
After being dangled above a boiling river by a hollow, this little drop didn't seem so frightening. And Emma was right. The ledge was wide, and decorative knobs and gargoyle faces protruded everywhere from the masonry, making natural handholds. I climbed out, grabbed on, and shimmied along after her. When the ledge turned a corner and we felt fairly certain that we were paralleling a hallway out of Sharon's view, we tried opening a window. It was locked. We shimmied on and tried the next one, but it, too, was locked, as were the 3rd, 4th, and 5th windows. "We're running out of building," I said. "What if none of them open?"
"This next one will," Emma said.
"How do you know?"
"I'm clairvoyant."
And with that, she kicked it, sending shattered glass into the room and tinkling down the front of the building.
"No, you're a hoodlum," I said.
Emma grinned at me and then knocked the last few shards from the frame with the flat of her hand. She stepped through the opening. I followed, somewhat reluctantly, into a dark and cavernous room. It took a moment for our eyes to adjust. The only light came from the window shade we'd just broken, its puny glow revealing the edge of a pack rat's paradise. Wooden crates and boxes climbed to the ceiling in teetering stacks, leaving only a small aisle between them.
"I get the feeling Bentham doesn't like to throw things away," Emma said.
In reply, I released a rapid-fire triple sneeze. The air was swimming with dust. Emma blessed me and lit a flame in her hand, which she held up to the nearest crate. It was labeled RM AM 157.
"What do you think is in them?" I said.
"We'd need a crowbar to find out," said Emma. "These are sturdy."
"I thought you were clairvoyant." She made a face at me. Lacking a crowbar, we ventured farther into the room, Emma enlarging her flame as we left the petering window light behind. The narrow path between the boxes led through an arched door and into another room, which was equally dark and nearly as cluttered. Instead of crates, it was crammed with bulky objects hidden beneath white dust covers. Emma was about to pull one away, but before she could, I caught her arm.
"What's wrong?"
she said, annoyed.
"There might be something awful under there."
"Yes, exactly," she said, and tore away the cover, which scared up a cyclone of dust.
When the air cleared, we saw ourselves reflected dimly in a glass-topped case of the sort you find in museums, waist high and about 4 feet square. Inside, neatly arranged and labeled, were a carved coconut husk,
a whale vertebra fashioned into a comb, a small stone axe, and a few other items, the usefulness of which wasn't immediately obvious. A placard on the glass read, "Housewares used by peculiars on the island of Espiritu Santo, New Hebrides, South Pacific region, circa 1750.
"Huh,"
Emma said. "Weird," I replied. She replaced the dust cover, even though there was little use in covering our tracks. It wasn't as if we could unbreak the window, and we moved slowly through the room, uncovering other objects at random. All were museum displays of one type or another. The contents bore little relation to one another, save that they had once been owned or used by peculiars. One contained a selection of brightly colored silks worn by peculiars in the Far East, circa 1800. Another displayed what appeared at first glance to be a wide cross-section of tree trunk, but upon closer inspection was in fact a door with iron hinges and a knob made from a tree knot. Its placard read, "Entrance to a peculiar home in the great Hibernian wilderness, circa 1530.
"Wow," Emma said, leaning in for a closer look. "I never knew there were so many of us in the world."
"Or used to be," I said. "I wonder if they're still out there." The last display we looked at was labeled "Weaponry of the Hittite Peculiars, Kemakli Underground City, no date." Bafflingly, all we could see inside were dead beetles and butterflies. Emma swung her flame around to look at me.
"I think we've established that Bentham's a history buff. Ready to move on?"
We hurried through two more rooms filled with dust-covered display cases, then arrived at a utilitarian staircase, which we climbed to the next floor. The landing door opened onto a long and lushly carpeted hallway. It seemed to go on forever, its regularly spaced doors and repeating wallpaper creating a dizzying impression of endlessness. We walked along, peeking into rooms. They were furnished identically, laid out identically, wallpapered identically. Each had a bed, a night table, and a wardrobe, just like the room I'd recuperated in. A pattern of red poppy vines curled across the wallpaper and continued through the carpeting in hypnotic waves, making the whole place seem like it was being slowly reclaimed by nature. In fact, the rooms would have been entirely indistinguishable had it not been for the small brass plaques nailed to the doors, which gave each a unique name. All were exotic-sounding. The Alps Room, the Gobi Room, the Amazon Room. Perhaps 50 rooms lined the hallway, and we were halfway down its length, hurrying now, certain there was nothing of use to be discovered here, when a blast of air rolled over us that was so cold it prickled my skin.
"Whew!"
I said, hugging myself. "Where'd that come from?"
"Could be someone left a window open," Emma said.
"But it's not cold outside," I said, and she shrugged. We continued down the hall, the air chilling more the farther we went. Finally, we turned a corner and came to a section of hall where icicles had formed on the ceiling and frost glistened on the carpet. The cold seemed to be emanating from one room in particular, and we stood before it watching flakes of snow waft one by one from the crack beneath its door.
"That is very strange," I said, shivering. "Definitely unusual,"
Emma agreed.
"Even by my standards."
I stepped forward, my feet crunching on the snowy carpet, to examine the plaque on the door. It read, "The Siberia Room." I looked at Emma. She looked at me.
"It's probably just a hyperactive air conditioner," she said.
Let's open it and find out, I said. I reached for the knob and tried it, but it wouldn't turn.
It's locked.
Emma put her hand on the knob and kept it there for several seconds. It began to drip water as ice melted from inside it.
Not locked, she said. Frozen.
She twisted the knob and pushed the door, but it opened only an inch. Snow was piled up on the other side. We put our shoulders to its surface and, on the count of three, shoved. The door flung open and a gust of Arctic air slapped us. Snow flurried everywhere, into our eyes, into the hall behind us. Shielding our faces, we peered inside. It was furnished like the other rooms, bed, wardrobe, night table, but there were indistinct humps of white buried under deep piled snow.
"What is this?"
I said, shouting to be heard above the wind's howl.
"Another loop? It can't be,"
Emma shouted back.
"We're already in one."
Leaning into the wind, we stepped inside for a closer look. I'd thought that the snow and ice were coming through an open window, but then the flurry abated, and I saw there was no window at all, not even a wall at the far end of the room. Ice-coated walls stood on either side of us, a ceiling above us, and probably a carpet was somewhere below our feet, but where a fourth wall should have been, the room gave way to an ice cave, and beyond that, to open air, open ground, and an endless vista of white snow and black rocks. This was, as near as I could tell, Siberia. A single track of shoveled snow led through the room and into the whiteness beyond. We shuffled down the path, out of the room and into the cave, marveling at everything around us. Giant spikes of ice rose from the floor and hung from the ceiling like a forest of white trees. Emma was hard to impress. She was nearly 100 years old and had seen a lifetime's worth of peculiar things. But this place seemed to fill her with genuine wonder.
"This is astonishing,"
she said, bending to scoop up a handful of snow. She tossed it at me, laughing.
"Isn't it astonishing?"
"It is," I said through chattering teeth.
"But what's it doing here?"
We threaded between the giant icicles and emerged into the open. Looking back, I could no longer see the room at all. It was perfectly camouflaged inside the cave. Emma hurried ahead, then turned back and said,
"Over here!"
in an urgent voice. I shuffled through deepening snow to her side. The landscape was bizarre. Before us was a white, flat field, past which the ground fell away in deep, undulating folds, like crevasses.
"We're not alone,"
said Emma, and pointed to a detail I'd missed. A man was standing at the edge of a crevasse, peering down into it.
"What's he doing?"
I said, more or less rhetorically.
"Looking for something, it would seem."
We watched him walk slowly along the crevasse, always staring down. After about a minute, I realized I was so cold that I could no longer feel my face. A gust of snowy wind blew up and blanked the scene. When it died down a moment later, the man was staring right at us. Emma stiffened.
"Uh-oh. Do you think he sees us?"
Emma looked down at her bright, yellow dress.
"Yes."
We stood there for a moment, our eyes locked on the man as he stared at us across the white wasteland, and then he took off running in our direction. He was hundreds of yards away through deep snow and a landscape of undulating fissures. It was unclear whether he meant us harm,
but we were in a place we weren't supposed to be, and it seemed like the best thing to do was leave, a decision that was soundly reinforced by a howl, the likes of which I'd heard only once before, in the gypsies' camp. A bear. A quick look over our shoulders confirmed it. A giant black bear had clawed its way up from one of the crevasses to join the man on the snow, and they were both coming after us, the bear clearing ground much more quickly than the man. "Bear!" I shouted, redundantly. I tried to run, but my frozen feet refused to cooperate. Seemingly impervious to the cold, Emma grabbed my arm and swept me along. We lurched back into the cave, stumbled through the room, and tripped out the door, around which a penumbra of blowing snow was filling the hallway. I pulled the door shut behind us, as if that would stop a bear, and we retraced our steps down the long hall, down the stairs, and back into Bentham's dead museum to hide ourselves among his white-draped phantoms. We hid between a wall and a hulking, dust-sheeted monolith in the farthest corner we could find, straight-jacketing ourselves into a space so narrow that we could not turn to face each other, the cold we'd run from settling firmly into our bones. We stood silent and shivering, stiff as mannequins, the snow on our clothes melting into puddles at our feet. Emma's left hand took my right. It was all the warmth and meaning we could trade. We were developing a language that was entirely untranslatable into words, a special vocabulary of gestures and glances and touches and increasingly deep kisses that was growing richer, more intense, more complex by the hour. It was fascinating and essential, and in moments like this made me just a little less cold and a little less scared than I might have been otherwise. When, after a few minutes, no bears showed up to eat us, we dared to exchange whispers.
"Was that a loop we were in?" I asked. "A loop within a loop?"
"I don't know what that was," Emma replied.
"Siberia. That's what the door said."
"If that was Siberia, then the room it was in was some kind of portal, not a loop. And portals don't exist, of course."
"Of course," I replied, though it wouldn't have been so strange to believe, in a world where time loops existed, that portals did too.
"What if it was just a really old loop?" I suggested. "Like Ice Age old, 10 or 15,000 years. Devil's Acre might have looked like that back then."
"I don't think there are any loops that ancient," Emma said.
My teeth chattered.
"I can't stop shaking," I said.
Emma pressed her side to mine and rubbed my back with her warm hand.
"If I could make a portal to anywhere," I said, "Siberia would not be high on my list of choices."
"Where would you go, then?"
"Hawaii, maybe? Though I guess that's boring. Everyone would say Hawaii."
"Not me."
"Where would you go?"
"The place you're from," Emma said. "In Florida."
"Why on earth would you want to go there?"
"I think it'd be interesting to see where you grew up."
"That's sweet," I said. "There's not much to it, though. It's really quiet."
She leaned her head on my shoulder and exhaled a warm breath down my arm.
"Sounds like heaven."
"You've got snow in your hair," I said,
but it melted when I tried to brush it out. I shook the cold water from my hand onto the floor, and that's when I noticed our footprints. We'd left a trail of melting snow that probably led right to our hiding spot.
"What
dimwits we are, I said, pointing out the tracks. We should have left our shoes behind.
It's okay, said Emma. If they haven't tracked us by now, they probably...
Loud, clonking footsteps echoed from across the room, accompanied by the sound of a large animal breathing.
Back to the window, quick as you can,
Emma hissed, and we wormed out of our hiding spot. I tried to run, but slipped in a puddle. I grabbed the closest thing at hand, which happened to be the sheet covering the large object we'd been hiding behind. The sheet came ripping away, uncovering another display case with a resounding zzzwit, and landing me on the floor in a pile of rumpled canvas. When I looked up, the first thing I saw was a girl, not Emma, who was standing above me, but past her, inside the case, behind the glass. She had a perfectly angelic face and a ruffled dress and a bow in her hair, and she stared glassily at nothing in what seemed the permanent rictus of a taxidermied human being. I freaked. Emma turned to see what I was freaking out about, and then she freaked. She dragged me to my feet, and we ran. I'd forgotten all about the guy chasing us, the bear, Siberia. I just wanted to get out of that room, away from the stuffed girl, and far away from any possibility that Emma and I might end up like her, dead and encased behind glass. Now I knew all I needed to know about this Bentham guy. He was some kind of twisted collector, and I was sure that if we looked under more dust covers, we'd find more specimens like the girl. We sped around a corner, only to find, towering before us, a terrifying 10-foot mountain of fur and claws. We screamed, tried too late to stop running, and slid into a pile at the bear's feet. There we cowered, waiting to die. Hot, stinking breath rolled over us. Something wet and rough mopped the side of my face. I'd been licked by a bear. I'd been licked by a bear, and someone was laughing.
"Calm yourself, he won't bite," the someone said,
and I uncovered my face to see a long, furry nose and big brown eyes staring down at me. Had the bear spoken? Do bears talk about themselves in the third person?
"His name's P.T.," the someone continued, "and he's my bodyguard. He's quite friendly, provided you stay on my good side. P.T., sit!"
P.T. sat, then began licking his paw instead of my face. I flipped myself right side up, wiped the slobber from my cheek, and finally saw the owner of the voice. He was an older man, a gentleman, and he wore a subtle smirk that complemented his killer outfit. Top hat, cane, gloves, and a high white collar that rose from the top of his dark jacket. He bowed slightly and tipped his hat.
"Myron Bentham, at your service."
"Back away slowly,"
Emma whispered in my ear, and we stood up together and sidestepped out of the bear's reach.
"We don't want any trouble, mister. Just let us go and no one gets hurt."
Bentham spread his arms and smiled.
"You're free to leave any time you like. But that would be such a disappointment. You've only just arrived, and we have so much to talk about."
"Yeah?" I said. "Maybe you can start by explaining that girl in the case over there."
"And the Siberia room," said Emma.
"You're upset, you're cold, and you're wet. Wouldn't you rather discuss all this over a pot of hot tea?"
"Yes, but I wasn't going to say so."
"We're not going anywhere with you until we know what's happening here," said Emma.
"Very well,"
Bentham replied, not losing an ounce of his good humor. That was my assistant you surprised in the Siberia room, which, as you likely gathered, leads to a time loop in Siberia.
But that's impossible, said Emma. Siberia is thousands of miles away.
3,489, he replied. But making interloop travel possible has been my life's work. He turned to me. As for the case you uncovered, that's Sophronia Winstead. She was the first peculiar child born to the royal family of England. Fascinating life she led, if a bit tragic in the end. I have all sorts of notable peculiars here in my peculiarium, well known and unknown, famous and infamous, any or all of which I'm happy to show you. I have nothing to hide.
He's a psycho, I muttered to Emma. He just wants to stuff us and add us to his collection.
Bentham laughed. His hearing apparently was very sharp. They're only wax models, my boy. I am a collector and a preservationist, yes, but not of humans. Do you really think I waited so long to meet you, only to pull out your insides and lock you in a cabinet? I've heard of stranger hobbies, I said, thinking of Enoch and his army of homunculi. What is it you want with us? All in good time, he said. Let's get you warm and dry first. Then tea. Then...
I don't mean to be rude, Emma cut in, but we've spent too much time here already. Our friends...
are all right for the moment, Bentham said. I've looked into the matter, and it isn't as close to midnight for them as you might imagine.
How do you know? Emma said quickly. What do you mean, it isn't close?
What do you mean, looked into it? I said, talking over her. All in good time, Bentham repeated. I know it's difficult, but you must be patient. There's too much to tell all at once, and in such a sorry state. He stretched out an arm toward us. Look, you're shivering.
Fine, then, I said. Let's have tea.
Excellent, said Bentham. He rapped his cane twice on the floor. P.T., come! The bear grunted in an agreeable sort of way, stood on its hind legs, and walked, waddling like a stubby-legged fat person, to where Bentham stood. Upon reaching him, the animal bent down and scooped him into the air, carrying him like a baby, one paw supporting his back and the other his legs.
"I know it's an unconventional way to travel," Bentham said over P.T.'s bushy shoulder, "but I tire easily."
He pointed ahead of them with his cane and said,
"P.T., library!"
Emma and I watched in amazement as P.T. began to walk away with Mr. Bentham.
"You don't see that every day,"
I thought, which was true of nearly everything I'd seen that day.
"P.T., stop!"
Bentham commanded. The bear stopped. Bentham waved to us.
"Are you coming?"
We'd been staring.
"Sorry,"
Emma said. And we ran to catch up. We wended our way through the maze after Bentham and his bear.
"Is your bear peculiar?" I asked.
"Yes, he's a grim bear,"
said Bentham, rubbing P.T.'s shoulder affectionately.
"They are the preferred companion of Imbrins in Russia and Finland, and grim bear taming is an old and respected art among peculiars there. They're strong enough to fight off a hollowgast, yet gentle enough to care for a child. They're warmer than electric blankets on winter nights, and they make fearsome protectors, as you'll see here. P.T., left!"
As Bentham extolled the virtues of grim bears, we came into a small anteroom. Under a glass canopy in the middle of the room were three ladies, and, towering over them, a giant, vicious-looking bear. My breath caught for a moment before I realized they were motionless, another of Bentham's displays.
That's Miss Waxwing, Miss